the BBC. The United States is expected to deepen its already close ties with its East Asian allies, Japan and South Korea, at a summit at President Biden's retreat, Camp David, later. The three countries' leaders will discuss a joint approach to dealing with the growing power of China and the nuclear threat posed by North Korea. The authorities in Canada are stepping up emergency evacuation flights from the remote northern city of Yellowknife, which is threatened by wildfires. All 20,000 residents have been told to leave within hours. A separate fire has triggered a state of emergency and an evacuation order for parts of the city of Kelowna in British Columbia. Canada's Federal Minister for Environment and Climate Change, Stephen Guilbeault, told the BBC the wildfire season was the worst on record.
So it is by far the worst forest fire season in our history from that perspective. At one point, the federal government had requested to send Canadian armed forces in four jurisdictions at the same time, which is unheard of. To give you an idea of the size that this has been burned in terms of square kilometers, it's larger than Greece. So it is an incredibly difficult year from that perspective.
The United Nations has warned that unless new funding arrives, it will have to cut food aid to more than 4 million people in Yemen from September. Many of those affected will be women and children already suffering from some of the highest malnutrition rates in the world. A Russian Orthodox priest is being investigated by church authorities after he was filmed blessing a statue of Joseph Stalin. The 8-metre-high monument was officially unveiled last Tuesday in the western city of Velikiye Luka. Video on social media shows a figure in clerical robes sprinkling holy water. A statement from his local diocese said the priest's actions did not represent the church's views. BBC News.
Welcome to The Morning Magazine on KGNU Community Radio. It's Friday, August 18th of 2023. I'm your host, Alexis Kenyon. Up first on today's show, I talk with Shay Castle about last night's Boulder City Council meeting. They voted to change the city's zoning laws. After that, it's Sports Talk with Jimmy and then .org, our Friday spotlight on local nonprofits. Coming up after the BBC headlines at 8:30, Eli Kalin is talking to Josie Nixon, the executive director of a curated storytelling event that is traveling across the Front Range. Then at 9:30, it's the Morning Sound Alternative. That's all coming up, but first, these headlines with KGNU's Benita Lee.
Part of I-70 in Glenwood Canyon was closed for a few hours last night following reports of mudslides. The National Weather Service issued a flash flood advisory as a thunderstorm dumped rain in the area at around 5 p.m. By 9 p.m., the Colorado Department of Transportation had reopened the corridor between Dotsero and West Glenwood. The Denver Catholic Archdiocese officials approved a settlement Wednesday that will increase electricity bills for 1.6 million Coloradans starting September 1st. Xcel Energy, the state's largest electricity supplier, sought a $312 million rate hike last year. The Public Utilities Commission agreed to roughly a third of that amount. The $96 million increase means costs will rise 4.4%, almost $4 on the average home electrical bill. A Colorado ski resort company is officially set to pay the state after dumping hazardous snowmaking water into local creeks. KGNU and Report for America's Jackie Sedley has more.
Vail Mountain will pay $275,000 to the state of Colorado for accidentally releasing hazardous water from its snowmaking system into Mill and Gore Creeks back in 2021. The spill killed at least 120 fish, damaged about 1.5 miles of water, and turned the creeks a blue-gray color. The snowmaking water contained chlorine and an algaecide, toxic to fish but not to humans when diluted in water. The majority of the settlement money will be used for a restoration project in the Gore Creek Basin, with the remaining funds going toward the Water Quality Improvement Fund. For KGNU and Report for America, I'm Jackie Sedley.
A second lawsuit was filed Thursday over the Universal Pre-K Program, or UPK. this time by multiple school districts and the Colorado Association of School Executives. The suit said the program prevents districts from accommodating students with disabilities as is legally required and denies local control over preschool enrollment, staffing, and funding. Governor Jared Polis, the Colorado State Board of Education, and the Colorado Department of Early Childhood are named in the suit filed by Cherry Creek, Westminster, and other school districts. The first lawsuit was filed Wednesday by the Denver Archdiocese. It claimed that UPK's requirement that preschools accept LGBTQ families and students violates Catholic schools' First Amendment rights to follow their religious practices. Colorado's medical board decided Thursday that doctors who prescribe the abortion reversal pill are not following the state's accepted standard of practice. The pill, which is progesterone, has been used in a controversial attempt to undo the effects of mifepristone, a common but also controversial abortion drug. According to the Colorado Sun, the board members, who are mostly doctors, heatedly debated the topic for hours. Some wanted an outright ban of the abortion reversal pill, while others wanted to examine its use by doctors on a case-by-case basis. Their final decision spanned both sides. While the board said prescribing the pill will not be automatically viewed as unprofessional conduct, doctors who use it to reverse an abortion will be investigated. Earlier this year, Governor Jared Polis signed the first law in the country to ban the abortion reversal pill as an unethical procedure. Colorado health officials say the number of West Nile virus cases since July are already notably higher than in recent years. The Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment confirmed 36 human cases of the virus in the state. They report that 19 people were hospitalized with severe neurological symptoms and one person died. According to the Denver Post, state epidemiologist Rachel Herlihy said the numbers are unprecedented. The cases in horses are high as well. The Colorado Department of Agriculture says 20 horses have been diagnosed with West Nile virus this summer. Of those 20, 4 have died and 3 were euthanized. While there's no vaccine against West Nile for people, there is a vaccine for horses. Agriculture officials say horses immunized in past years will need an annual booster. If you're a fan of peaches, you're in luck this weekend. There are two events centered around the summer fruit, the 55th annual Palisade Peach Festival and the 17th annual Lafayette Peach Festival. Both celebrations offer music, vendors, activities, and, of course, Colorado's well-loved Palisade peaches. Partly sunny today with a chance of showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon and evening. In Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins, highs near 94 and lows around 65. For KGNU, I'm Benita Lee.
You're listening to The Morning Magazine on KGNU. I'm Alexis Kenyon. Last night, the city of Boulder voted to increase occupancy limits across the city. The previous occupancy limits in Boulder allowed for a maximum of 3 unrelated people to live in a single-family home. The new ordinance would increase that limit to 5. Occupancy limits are something that have been a big point of contention and discussions across the U.S. in recent years. California, Oregon, and Washington have all voted to prohibit local governments from regulating occupancy limits based on family status. State lawmakers in Colorado attempted to outlaw occupancy limits like those in Boulder earlier this year, but the bill failed on the final day of the legislative session. Joining me to tell us more about last night's Boulder City Council vote is Shay Castle, the founder of Boulder Beat News. Shay, welcome.
Good morning.
So to start, for those who have not been following this story, give us some context for last night's vote and the discussion.
Well, that's a big question because occupancy limits have been debated for years in Boulder, longer than I've been here, which is 11 years. But the most recent context is there was a ballot measure originally supposed to be on the ballot in 2020, but City Council changed its rules in the midstream and kept it off. And then it was on the ballot in 2021 to tie occupancy to the size of the home. That failed, but a majority of council members, six council members, all ran and were voted in on increasing occupancy limits. And the entire council, all nine, voted to put it as an item on their work plan, their number one item. So there's been a lot of energy around this, and this council has checked in on occupancy three or four times in the last 2 years.
So it was on the ballot in 2021, I believe, in Boulder's ballot. They voted it down. I mean, how did it wind up in City Council's hands? How did that happen?
It's actually gone back and forth for years. So a couple years ago, we had Bob Yates and former council member Sam Weaver say, like, hey, this is for the voters to decide because some boards ask for council to take it up. And then the measure that was on the ballot was to increase occupancy to the number of bedrooms plus one. That failed. But as I said, a majority of council members on council did want to do something with occupancy. And even Bob Yates, you know, gave an interview and famously said in public, like, yeah, we should do something about occupancy. There's been pressure from the state, as you mentioned. Jared Polis asked that, you know, we stop enforcing occupancy during the pandemic. Boulder declined. We haven't been enforcing it for some time. But just as the state's housing crisis deepens, this is a way that a lot of folks see to legalize it, the way people are, already living, or possibly open up some additional housing units.
You know, it's interesting because Boulder sees itself as such a progressive city, and yet we're one of the cities who made it so that the state would not be able to pass this law. It seems like, but at the same time, they voted in people into City Council who would pass this law. It just seems like there's a lot of conflicting interests and also like ideas about people, about Boulder's identity. How did that play out in this conversation?
You definitely saw that, and you definitely saw opponents, you know, being very down on the six council members who voted for this, saying it was a subversion of democracy and an overturning of the election results. The mechanism is different, and that's what the council members who voted for this occupancy increase really focused on. We did hear a lot of concern over the Bedrooms Are for People ballot measure in 2021, which is what failed, that if we tied the amount of occupancy to the size of the building, we might see redevelopment of buildings to have, you know, 8 bedrooms, 10 bedrooms. Occupancy limits are incredibly common in college towns. A lot of university towns have them because of the challenges of overoccupancy. So I think the supporters of doing occupancy this way, which is just a higher cap, regardless of the size of the unit, it's 5 people, not tied to the size of the bedrooms. I think they felt that that would address concerns over redevelopment, but still open up these housing choices, which is, again, something they all campaigned on. And that does seem like a conflicting message, but, you know, sometimes that's how it happens. I think people are aware there's a severe housing crisis. And as always, there's so much disagreement and controversy over what to do about that.
Do you think that this change in ordinance is enough to really make any kind of large impact, or do you think Boulder will need to do more?
Absolutely, Boulder will need to do more. I mean, what we hear from all the experts, what we see from the research and the data is that you kind of have to do everything, which makes it really tricky to do anything, because none of these one single things has the supporting evidence of, like, oh yes, this one thing will help with affordability. That's another talking point we heard a lot last night, is this is not going to help. To be fair, the data that does exist out there is not much, does suggest that higher occupancy limits do lead to lower rates. Sharing housing is, if anyone here shares housing, you know it's cheaper. I have 4 roommates. I pay $775 a month for my room. But this is obviously not a panacea. I do think it's worth noting, and this cuts both ways, both to people saying, like, oh, this will open up so much housing, and to people saying, oh my gosh, this is going to increase renters by so much and be a disaster. I don't think that's true. We've heard from so many people on both sides that folks are already living overoccupied. I am living over-occupied, and I've made no secret about that. I don't think people follow these occupancy limits, you know, renting their own private homes out or such. So the impact, I think, will be smaller than both sides fear. That being said, the impact to people living illegally, even though Boulder is not currently enforcing, we have heard from people who've been forced against. I think what they have said is this will make a big difference in making them feel more secure in their housing.
I mean, so when Boulder passed this legislation, it was in the 1960s, it may be 1960, the zoning law legislation, it was directed at student housing. And is this resolution or this new ordinance and this vote about student housing, or is it about affordable housing, or are they one and the same? You know, what is this tension about?
I think rent, any issue where we talk about renters automatically gets conflated with students, because students do rent in this town. We have a large student population, and students are the ones who tend to have the more noise, the more parties, the more trash. Although we do know from the data, it's a small number of properties causing most of the problems. And I think Nicole Spear said it really well, Councilwoman Nicole Spear, like, we're kind of using a sledgehammer. There's not actually any data, and we heard this from city staff, tying occupancy to nuisance. It is about the student population causing nuisances. And I think the folks who supported this on council really want to focus on those nuisance ordinance, the trash, the noise, the parking, rather than, you know, defining where and how people can live in a way that affects far more than just students. As we all know, half this town is renters. They're not all students.
How do you think, so if people aren't really following this rule to begin with, why was it such a big deal for it to be passed?
I think it is a big deal on University Hill. When you have a large property management company, they have more scrutiny on them. They apply for rental licenses. The places that are running it like a business, not like a private individual renting out their home or renting out extra bedrooms in their home, they do have to get rental licenses. And well, everyone's supposed to get a rental license, but people don't. And they do have to follow occupancy. And I think because of the issues we've seen on the Hill, the riots, the trash, the noise, the parties, folks are really concerned. And I want to say not just on the Hill. There's lots of neighborhoods where folks have had issues with young people renting and being loud and, you know, not living like they wish their neighbors would. That's why it's a big deal. People feel like these things have increased over the years, which I thought was another really great point from Nicole Spears. Like, occupancy limits haven't changed, but our nuisances have gotten worse. So clearly they're not working to enforce those. Council has made a number of changes to try to rein in those problem behaviors, and they have more coming later this fall. But it's not a small thing to live in a house where you're kept up to 2 a.m. every day, you know. I definitely want to have some empathy and hold some space for folks who are impacted by those issues.
I'm going to give you 30 seconds because we have to wrap up. But is there anything else that you want to add that I missed or you think people should know?
I think while concerns are valid about nuisances, I do think this has a slight ring of moral panic. So I would like folks to, you know, we've seen this time and again, outsized concerns. This will ruin the neighborhood, be disastrous, this kind of inflamed rhetoric. And on the other side, like, this will save, you know, open up so much housing options. It's never as bad or as good as you think it is. So that's what I would caution, is all the information we have seems to point to this being like a small, helpful step, but not the end of the world.
Well, Shay, thank you so much for joining me. I really appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
Shay Castle is the founder of Boulder Beat News. I'm Alexis Kenyon. You're listening to KGNU. Up next, it's Sports Talk.
Guys, I'm getting ready to go into my final year of schooling ever. And you know what that means? No more math. Let's go. Hello and welcome back to Sports Talk with Jimmy. I am your host, Jimmy Searfoss, here with the best sports news and stories from across the Front Range. And today on KGNU's Best Sports Show, I have a special anniversary that will be taking place in just a few weeks. The University of Colorado's football team has recently been posting about the celebration of the 100th year of their home, Folsom Field, that will be taking place in 2023 and 2024. Now, 100 years is an insane number to think about, because that's even older than me. The stadium was originally opened in October 11th of 1924 as a replacement to Colorado's Gamble Field that was previously home to the football team, baseball team, and track and field team. Colorado doesn't even have a baseball team anymore. But when Folsom Field opened, it was actually originally known as Norland Field. Now, if that name sounds familiar, it is also the same name of Colorado's library right now, the biggest one on campus. But the president of Colorado at the time, President Norland, didn't like that too much. So when one of Colorado's winningest coaches, Fred Folsom, passed away, they decided he would be the perfect namesake, and it has stuck ever since. Now, originally, the stadium just seated around 26,000 people, but it was built for expansion, and expand it did. In 1956, the upper deck was added, nearly doubling the size of the structure to 45,000 people. But they were just getting started, because 12 years later, in 1968, the Block Fieldhouse was added and was originally a structure for the basketball team, but it was also connected to Folsom Field and added a 6-level press box. And let me tell you, as someone that has spent a considerable amount of time in there, it kind of really feels like it was built in 1968. In 1976, the bleachers were replaced with aluminum instead of the previous wood, and the total capacity of the stadium was 53,750, the most it has ever been. That number has actually been lowered since 2003, when some seats were taken out as they obstructed views. But with that came new luxury boxes in the eastern side of the stadium. Other additions to the field have been the Dow Ward Center, which can be seen on the north end of the field and includes some luxury boxes and seating, and the Touchdown Club, a very nice space for people to enjoy food and watch the game. Another addition broke ground in 2014 as the Champion Center became the latest luxury to the stadium. It features offices and brand new facilities in nearly every aspect for the football team and all other athletic programs. Lunch halls, office spaces, weight rooms, indoor turf facilities, name it, it's all there, and it's all very, very nice. And even still, Folsom isn't done growing. Remember those press boxes I was talking about earlier that were kind of old and run down? Well, those are actually going to get redone here in the future, and it's up to those in charge to pull the trigger, but I would expect that to happen sooner rather than later. So the Folsom Field 10 years from now could look very different than the Folsom Field we know now. Personally, the only thing that matters to me is that I always have that beautiful view of the Flatirons from Folsom Field, and I don't think that's going away anytime soon. And that is just about all the time I got for you today here on Sports Talk with Jimmy. I've been your host, Jimmy Searfoss. Make sure you tune in next week for some more here on KGNU.
Time now for .org, spotlighting the work of local nonprofits and co-ops. Hi, this is Chris Schultz with KGNews.org, and I'm here with Mike Friedman from Peddling Minds. You want to tell us a little bit about Peddling Minds and what you guys do?
Sure, man. We are a nonprofit organization that teach people to have fun learning how to ride bicycles with confidence and control. Control is the primary safety component that keeps someone safe and more likely to ride a bicycle. You know, what keeps you safer driving your car, having good control of your car, or wearing your seatbelt? Both are important, right? It's the same thing on a bicycle. When you wear a helmet, you're a safer rider, but does that helmet fit? And what prevents the accidents? Having control. So we teach people how to have, you know, have fun learning how to ride bicycles with confidence and control.
You know, that totally makes sense. And as a father of two, and I taught both my kids how to ride bikes, I began to wonder, you know, kind of what's the key difference between what you guys do and what a dad like me might do on the side.
You know, I have taken the last 8 years and broken it down step by step by step to really guide people through a process that creates a positive feedback loop so that it is a continuation and not met with resistance. I think people would be surprised at how many parents, but also kids struggle, not only in teaching their kids how to ride, but the child themselves learning how to ride and what that experience is like for them. And also, I don't think people realize how large of a problem it is for how many kids and adults that don't know how to ride a bicycle. It's an exponential problem. To answer your question, the difference is the curated curriculum that I have taken the last 9 years actually to develop. I moved to Colorado from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania to race bicycles. My dream was to become an Olympian. I was 8 years old when I established that dream. Met that goal in 2008. And then when I retired from professional cycling, I looked in the mirror the very night that I retired and realized that my identity had just completely changed. And I had had an experience earlier that year teaching this fifth grader who had been bullied in school for not knowing how to ride a bicycle. And it was life-changing for me in terms of what it meant for someone else and what I was able to help teach. It's definitely grown since then because, let's face it, control goes way beyond pedaling. Think about when you're driving, right? You don't just hit the gas pedal and hit the brake. There's all these subconscious things that you do that creates control. You know, I mean, you can be pedaling, but you're still a very beginner rider.
When would a student consider an individual training over a group?
We have a lot of different formats. We run summer camps and after school programs. We run weekend clinics. We run adult camps. We run private lessons. The private lesson format it's designed to have that one-on-one experience because a lot of people and a lot of kids are embarrassed. They don't know anybody or they have a lot of fear and they come to a private lesson to learn how to pedal and get over that hurdle. And then we push them to camp because again, we might get you pedaling, but then we got to focus on braking. And if we don't get there in time, you're a rider that's completely out of control because just as important as pedaling is, so is braking. So yes, we do offer private lessons for a wide audience from kids to adults, kids with special needs. It's a wide range. We have scholarships available. We have really good programming and we transform kids and people's lives and families' lives by teaching their kids how to ride a bicycle. And by and large, we get a lot of kids that are neurodiverse and we get a lot of kids that show a lot of hesitation, a lot of fear. You know, we are really good at connecting those dots for those people. And that not only serves the child or the person we're working with, but also the people that they're living or riding with.
Being convicted for the murders of 7 babies and for the attempted murders of 6 others at a hospital in northwestern England. Lucy Letby is the most prolific killer of babies in modern Britain. The United States has given approval for F-16 fighter planes to be sent to Ukraine from Denmark and the Netherlands. Ukraine has repeatedly urged its Western allies to provide them. The BBC has been told that 1,400 people have starved to death in Ethiopia's northern region of Tigray since food aid was suspended in April. A senior Tigrayan official said the number of dead could be much higher. The former Austrian Chancellor, Sebastian Kurz, has been charged with lying to Parliament during an investigation into corruption. He's denied the charges. Saudi Arabia's de facto ruler, Mohammed bin Salman, has hosted talks with the Iranian foreign minister. The meeting in Jeddah is the latest sign of improving relations. The United Nations has warned that unless new funding arrives, it will have to cut food aid to more than 4 million people in Yemen from September. Many of those affected will be women and children. The UN says at least 22 aid workers have been killed in South Sudan this year. The country has become one of the world's most dangerous for humanitarian staff. Russia has closed down one of the country's oldest human rights groups. Moscow's Andrei Sakharov Center was created in 1996 in memory of the Nobel Prize laureate. And a Russian Orthodox priest is being investigated by church authorities after he was filmed blessing a statue of Joseph Stalin. The 8-metre-high monument was unveiled last Tuesday in the West Russian city of Velikiye Luki. BBC News.
Talk.
Talk show.
Talk back.
Talk radio.
Walk your talk.
Talk your talk. KGNU talk.
Call in.
Call in and talk.
Call in and connect.
Connections.
Friday mornings at 8:30
on KGNU.
Good morning. My name is Eli Kalin. I am joined today For Josie Nixon, director of Exposed, a storytelling series along the Front Range. And we are talking arts, culture, and how it affects society. Josie, welcome.
Thanks for having me, y'all. Excited to be here.
Yeah, definitely. So tell us a little bit about your Exposed series, and then we can jump into how arts and culture and how it affects society.
Yeah, general overview. It's a pretty simple concept. Take on the oldest form of art that we have, storytelling, how we pass down our history, how do we connect with the people around us. So what I do is I find some very brave, willing, courageous volunteers from our community. And I work with them for about 3 months to develop their more intense stories of their lives, the things that when, you know, you might be meeting a friend for coffee, you don't feel comfortable talking about the things that maybe only your therapist has heard. But really, the idea is that we focus on traumatic pieces of our identities, of our history. And during that 3 months, you know, I transform a first draft into a beautiful theatrical, rendition, true memoir read on stage for an audience about these really intense